this episode of This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you exclusively by Axia, on the web at axiaaudio.com. Go there and see what an IP audio studio can do for you. Axia, with over 2,000 consoles deployed around the world and working every day. Check it out at axiaaudio.com.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twirt. A lot of things going on out there, and plus it's an environment that's not hostile, but just borderline if you don't pay attention.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up, Dad?
Yeah. All your days are belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
We're talking about planning for the worst, and the worst I could find on this episode was me, Chris Tarr, and Chris Tobin.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
It's time for This Week in Radio Tech. Hi there, I'm Kirk Harnack, and so glad that you are with us. This is the show where we talk about radio technology, anything to do with, audio, audio metadata. Sometimes we even deal with video, like webcam video, streaming web video for radio stations and broadcasters. We talk about things like microphones, like this Shure SM5. Isn't that a pretty big, I call this the disease-a-phone. Why do you think that is? It's got a big disease-holding sponge on the front. Well, thanks for joining us. And along with me this evening are two of our regular co-hosts, and that is from New York City, the best dressed engineer in radio. It's Chris Tobin. Hey, Chris.
Hello, Kirk. How are you this evening?
I'm lovely. What's up in your part of the world?
Oh, the snow has finally melted. The temperatures have dropped below 30 degrees. Wind chills about minus 5. Other than that, it's very warm and comfortable.
You guys supposed to get some more snow later this week?
They're reporting a chance of snow flurries, precipitation, but so far nobody's holding any accumulations to our feet. But we'll see. They've been wrong before. So,
well, I'm here in Dallas, and they got rain, sleet, and snow last night and this morning. But most of it's melted now. Things are just a few patches of ice here and there. And let's see. You are with the CBS radio stations there, and you keep promising to give us a tour of the beautiful, gorgeous Hudson Street facility.
Yes, I know. There's been a few roadblocks in the way, but I think I've got most of them cleared. I'll know more in a couple of days. We've been doing a lot of making a lot of changes, that is, and it just didn't look right. Visually, it just wouldn't go over very well.
It was gorgeous when I visited you there a few months ago. It was beautiful. Did you guys mess it up?
Well, we've been doing some changes of equipment and moving things around in the racks, and it's just, you know, when you're in person, it looks like, it looks pretty cool. But I did a shot with a webcam and sort of moved around with a little dolly. It just doesn't look right.
Huh. It is funny how cameras pick up things that our eyes are willing to ignore.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And that's pretty much what it is.
You know, I've back when I worked at Scott Studios, we would do an installation of a Scott Studio system and have these big, beautiful, they were CRTs, but they were touch screens in a studio. And we'd stage we thought we were staging the studio to take a picture, right? And so we get back with a wide angle lens and take a picture of this studio with these beautiful Scott Studio touchscreens. And we go back and look at the picture. And I thought, man, that place looks bad. There's like pen marks all over the audio console. And there's pens laying around. And look at that. There's a paper log laying off to the side. You know, the human eye just ignores all this clutter that, of course, a camera picks up.
Well, that's exactly it. So I hope to have something ready soon. We're about 3 or 4 days, about 4 days away from finishing up what we're doing. And then I'll be able to get the cart in place and do a dry run with a webcam, Wi-Fi laptop, and see how it goes. But yes, here in New York City, I'm at the CBS radio stations. We have 6 of them in town. And as broadcast technologist, my job is to keep things moving along. And this week, we've been playing with the LTE technology from Verizon. So it's been working out really well.
We touched on that. How's that working out for you? As well as you thought it would?
Yes, much better than expected. I just the other night with a laptop and the 4G card, which I happen to have here, or the modem, I should say, the little guy, this guy right here. It's 4G, rolls back to 3G when necessary. I'm able to run 3 video web streams on a laptop plus an audio over IP application through a VPN tunnel back to my studios, and no interruption, no jitter. It works like a champ. Try to do the exact same thing with a 3G card, and I'm lucky if I can even get the one video stream not to stutter and stop installed.
Let's tell you what, hold that subject, hold that thought. Let's come back to that, because I want to hear some more about that and compare with my recent experiences with some Clear brand 4G. So I'm going to hear about that. Hey, also with us is Chris Tarr from Muckwonago, Wisconsin. Did I get it right, Chris?
You did, absolutely. And I'm looking outside at the 5 and 6 foot snowdrifts here. It's 2 below right now. And last week we had, as we mentioned, I wasn't here. I was tending to the radio stations. There's nothing like I had to spend the night out there because you know we had a big blizzard come through. And obviously, had I not been there, you know, if something happened, we would have been in trouble. So I spent the night at the radio station, and the building is you know a couple hundred feet from the towers. And I'll tell you, there's nothing like trying to, you know, laying there at 3 in the morning, 50 mile an hour winds blowing through the towers, trying to get some sleep. You know, all you can hear is the towers going, whoo. And every time you hear a creak or a crackle, you think that something's going on outside. You bolt up and look out the window. It was one of those, I haven't seen something like that in probably 10 or 15 years. And the result was the bunches of snow. And snow drifts of 6 to 8 feet in many areas. So finally recovered from all of that, and here I am.
You know, that's a great topic. We ought to touch on that a bit more during the show here, is when engineers have to stay at transmitter sites. What, you know, how do you prep a transmitter site? In your case, you stayed at the studio, but you've got transmitters there at the studio, don't you?
Yes, but I also have remote sites as well that we have plans for in case I get snowed in those situations too. So we do have, we do make preparations at all of our transmitter sites in case I have to do that. And by the way, I am the director of engineering for Intercom's radio stations in Madison and Milwaukee. There are 5 FMs and 1 AM.
And you can get in touch with Chris Tarr at geekjedi.com. You should go check that out. And Chris, you have some discussion forums there, don't you?
I do. I have also run the site broadcastengineering.info, and that's a site for engineers to get together and talk about war stories and ask questions. And we have a wiki, too, that we're starting to build that has a lot of information about broadcast engineering. And you can also follow me on Twitter at The Geek Jedi.
Now, the subject of keeping supplies at a transmitter site, I have never worked at any station. I've probably worked for 200 radio stations on a contract basis in my career. And I've never had to keep supplies at a transmitter site because I might get snowed in. They all happen to be in locations where you could get out one way or another. They weren't all that hard to access, except for one. There's an FM transmitter site that is just across the Mississippi River from Memphis, Tennessee. And this entire site is built on a floodplain. I'm not remembering all the call letters right now. For a while, one of the stations, the FM there was 101 Jams at 101.1. I think it was KJMS. And then AM was there. It was called KWAM, KWAM. 990 AM is a multi-tower directional array. But this entire site, the transmitter building was up on stilts that were at least 20, 25 feet tall. So you'd drive your car down, and you'd actually park under the transmitter building, then take the ladder up. But you didn't do that when the Mississippi River flooded, because this place was right next to the Mississippi River, and that would flood and flood over the entire floodplain. Then you had to take a little John boat, you know, a little paddle boat, over to the transmitter site. And the towers were all the same way. The tower bases were up on stilts, were elevated. And then there was, you could climb a ladder and go up to a little a platform and stand next to the tower. And that was where the tuning house was for the AM, for these AM towers. So there were several of those, and that was always exciting. Might be the right word to get to those things. Interestingly, at this transmitter site, it was manned 24 hours. An elderly couple lived in the transmitter building, and I'm not sure why that situation was like it was. I don't think it's like that anymore. But this elderly couple had they were the kind of folks that really liked a lot of cats and dogs. And so the transmitter site, much to the chagrin of engineers like myself, was filled with about 20 cats and dogs, mostly dogs, a couple of cats. And you can imagine we cleaned a lot of dog hair out of out of the air filters at this transmitter site. But we never had to stay there because of inclement weather. Again, there was this boat to get back and forth if the Mississippi River ever flooded.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say let's run to Chris Tobin, because he has sites that are probably a little easier to deal with. But Mr. Tarr, go ahead. What were you going to say?
I was going to mention that, you know, one of our sites, we actually did have somebody living on site for a while, and that's ended now. So we do at one of our sites, we actually have an apartment, which is kind of nice.
Ah, okay. So it's you have toilet there and refrigerator, stove.
Yeah, well, all of our sites, I mean, you know, the sites that we have that are remote sites, all of them have, we put water in there, we put, you know, some canned food, we put flashlights, a cot, blankets, because you never know. I mean, fortunately, we really haven't had any situations where that's been necessary, but you never know. In the summer, there's storms, and we do have flooding in some of those areas. And then, as you just mentioned, in the winter, there's certainly the possibility where you're out there, and, you know, it's safer not to leave and try to get out of there. It's safer to stay. So we oftentimes will, you know, stock all of our sites with that. I think we'll find that, especially in the Midwest, that pretty much any remote translator site is going to have at least the basics in there, because you just never know. And hopefully, you know, you never have to figure that out, but, you know, you want to be prepared in case you do.
I'm going to come back to your trying to go to sleep story in a minute. But Mr. Tobin, now, I know a lot of your transmitters are in the Empire State Building. I mean, you've got a Starbucks in the lower floors, right? And nice restaurants around.
Well, yeah, we do. We have a Heartland Brewery at the first floor of the Empire State Building for the FM transmitter sites. We have FedEx, so deliveries are good to go. And a few other places. Starbucks is one of them, a delicatessen, so you get some nice deli sandwiches. That's for the FM sites. We happen to be the owner of an island, so two of our AMs are on an island, right in Long Island Sound, actually. So we do have a cabin, a log cabin on the property, and up until about 2-3 years ago, we did have somebody as a caretaker live on the island and take care of things. And then the other AM site is in the swamps of the Meadowlands in New Jersey, and we do have supplies, but not the kind that we need because we're going to be snowed in. But you know, late nights out there in the swamplands, you're not going to be finding a store or a delicatessen to buy something on the overnight.
Hey, there's got to be an incredible history about this island that you guys own, where you said two AM transmitter sites there?
Yes, actually, there are two AMs, 50 kilowatts, diplex on a single tower. So it's 100,000 watts coming off the tower. that's a lot of RF out there.
Yes, it is.
So you could burn a cat's whisker real easy out there, no problem.
What's the name of this island?
It's called High Island. The original island that CBS occupied with NBC actually is now just a small little stone, a mound of dirt farther away from where our current site is. But this one is an island of its own. We do have a metal bridge that goes out to it. The tide comes and goes. We do have fencing around the shoreline. And from time to time, we do have folks who come by on boat and try to take our ground system. But we've been very fortunate last couple of years. We haven't had that happen recently. Let's see. Oh, the last storm we had, the nor'easter, we actually lost part of the shoreline, did erode. So we have to backfill that with some sand and gravel and make that work again. So yeah, we're maintaining a transmitter site, transmitters, towers, and landscaping of reinforcing the shoreline. So it's been fun.
Wow. I was just looking at this on there's a High Island down near Houston also. Got the wrong High Island. Okay, we'll get back to that. So how do you get, how far is this island from the mainland or from Long Island?
Well, High Island is actually just off the shore of City Island, which is part of the Bronx in New York City, the five boroughs. So you drive from the Bronx across to City Island. So you go one bridge over to City Island and then another bridge to High Island. As the crow flies, High Island is about, technically it's like 3 miles from Manhattan. It's part of the city, so it's not really off the mainland to the point where it's 10 minutes or 20-minute boat ride. But it's just an island that we own and maintain.
Hey,
we have fiber optics and
OC. I see it now. If you're following along at home, you can go to Google Maps and type in High Island, Bronx, New York, and there it is. And your tower is clearly visible on this on Google Maps. It is gorgeous. So you've got a transmitter building there. It looks like there's a couple of outbuildings behind the building. It looks like there's a house kind of in front of and to the southeast of the building. And then it looks like you've got a backup tower there as well.
That's correct. Yes, we do. We do have a backup tower that's out there. The one house that you see farthest is probably south or east of that tower is the log cabin, the residence on the island. The large White House is the actual transmit facility for two radio stations, two 50,000-watt AM stations. And then there's a smaller building, probably it would be west of that. That's the generator building. It's for the generator. And then that's about it. And then the rest is just an open island with a lot of Canadian geese that come by.
It looks like you don't actually have room on this island for a full quarter-wave ground system, do you?
No, we do. We do.
You do? Okay.
Yeah. And the nice thing is it goes right into the salt water of Long Island Sound, so it helps to bring out the signal. If you ever tune in to 880 or 660 AM, WCBS or WFAN, you'll know that those stations reach far and wide along the northeast.
And they're certainly non-directional with being being one tower. You must get out into the Atlantic Ocean very well.
Oh, yes, we do very well. There are folks that we get calls from at night. We have regular listeners on WFAN 660 out of the Washington, D.C. area. We've got some folks up north, northern New York State, that will call from time to time on CBS 880, the old news station. It's wild.
So how does, you know, I've been to a number of transmitter sites which had either had now or used to have a full-time caretaker, either somebody who lived there or somebody lived right next door or right nearby. And here we go. There's High Island on your screen. If you're watching, if you want to follow along at home, you can go to Google Maps and take a look at it. How tall is that tower, Chris?
That one is, I think, memory serves me right, 600 feet. That tower. Okay. The history of that tower is in 1967 was struck by an airplane. By the way, that location, High Island, is situated between very, very busy air traffic airspace, mm-hmm. JFK International Airport to the south, and LaGuardia Airport to the west. And then there's a smaller airport, Bradley Airport in Hartford. So, we watch folks go by in planes all the time, and it's interesting. But, yeah, 1967, a plane did hit the tower and took down part of it. Matter of fact, portion of the original tower still sits in the ground at an angle from where it impacted.
Oh, my gosh.
It's fun to take people out there and say, yeah, see that tower section, that small piece of metal, that was up there many years ago. It just came right down and impaled the land, if you will.
Wow.
Yeah, we take our tower lighting and obstruction painting very seriously there.
So why is it that some tower sites, seems like especially some really high power tower sites, had a full-time caretaker who lived there? And how is it that that management or that they can be decided to not have somebody live there anymore?
Well, part of the history of our caretakers was because the island, access to the island was not always easy at the wintertime. Maintenance of the island was necessary for two reasons. One, back in the day, the technology transmitters did drift. The FCC regulations did require somebody on site to take readings on a regular basis. So that's the early, early days. But back in the 70s, the 80s, even the 90s, maintaining the facility, you know, cutting the grass, chasing the ducks away, walking the perimeter and making sure that everything is still intact. It's an island that's subject to the weather, to the elements, high tide, low tide, land erosion, a lot of things going on out there, and plus two high-powered AM sites, the transmitters that need to be an eye kept on. It's an environment that's not hostile, but just borderline if you don't pay attention. Now that we don't have a caretaker, it has required that we spend more time. Our guys, we rotate guys out there at least twice a week to check on stuff. And it's not uncommon to get out there, say, during the summer months and discover because of the temperature changes in the water, the salt air does wonderful things to metal objects, as you can imagine. So in summertime, we're constantly checking on the air conditioning system to make sure it's filtering properly. In wintertime, the ice just builds up out there with the moisture from the sound. The air temperature changes. Ice builds up on things like crazy, and it's dropping everywhere. And I think recently we had a couple of ice shards of ice come off the tower, the guy wires, and hit some of the air conditioning units. So it's there's a lot to be done.
So I've seen a number of sites like this that had an auxiliary tower on the property. Like in Nashville, where I live, WSM has this, you know, big monstrosity, this Blaw-Knox diamond-shaped tower. And then there's a little tower off to the side. So how does a company decide, you know what, we need to have a backup tower at our transmitter site? You know, most people don't have a backup tower. They may have a backup site somewhere else or a backup transmitter. But you actually put two towers on the same site where you don't need two towers for directionality purposes. You have a you have one for backup. How does that get decided in the economic scheme of things?
Well, you basically have to do a risk assessment. Are you willing to be off the air for maintenance during the course of the day or at night? Or do you run the numbers and say, well, it's worth the investment because we'll need to be on that backup tower during tower light changing, tower inspections. Maybe there's a problem with the main tower feed, because remember, there are two radio stations feeding this tower, so you have twice the revenue that you're going to lose if something goes wrong, and that's where you justify it. Now, it's a quarter-wave tower. It's much smaller, and at those wavelengths, it's really short. So not running 50,000 watts into the tower, we're running a half our power. I was going to say, not 100,000, we're running probably about 50,000 into the antenna. So 25,000 watts each station. But we're on the air, and that's what's important. And that's how you look at it. Just as our FM sites have backups to the Empire State Building. How do you justify that? Well, are you willing to be off the air? And if so, then don't worry about it. If you're not willing to be off and you know the revenue you lose is considerable, the backup site becomes, the economies of scale makes sense. And, not every market you can support that, but in the New York market, as you can imagine, a minute's worth of airtime is, easily $2,000 to $3,000 a minute. So, do the math and you'll see why it's worth spending, $500,000 or $700,000 to build an alternate site.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. Hey, let's go to Chris Tarr, if you're still awake. Chris, you still there?
I'm still here.
All right. So I was wanting to know about this experience you had just last week where you decided to sleep overnight at the studio/transmitter site. And you've got a number of towers there for this AM directional as well as some FMs, huh?
That's right. I have a five-tower directional array for our AM, and one of our FMs is located there. And then also we have the studio site for another one of our FMs. And for those of you who follow me on Facebook, my entries were pretty funny. got a little slap happy later on. But, we were going into a situation, and again, that's where you do the assessment, is, as we saw this storm coming, we all met on Monday. The storm came on Tuesday night into Wednesday. So on Monday, we all got together and discussed the risks and what was going on and what our plans were going to be. And we decided at that point, okay, we know that the storm is going to be bad. We're going to follow along. And at that point, I made the decision, if the weather holds, then I'm going to, I was going to spend the night. Because if something were to happen and I was at home, there was no way that I was going to be able to make it to the radio station to keep them on the air. And even though I couldn't get to the one FM site, the remote FM site, at least I could keep two of the three on the air if I was there. And, we have generators and the like. So, now, for example, my Madison stations, we don't have generators, so I didn't have anybody stationed there because if we were off the air, there was not anything we could do about it. But in our situation, we were more concerned about the power going out or something like that, and generators need to be come on. So on Monday, I had the generators guys come out. We did all the generator maintenance, make sure that everything was working. Then on Tuesday, we went and stocked up on food, bought a bunch of canned food and things like that. And here's the most important thing is we did at least have one person for each of the radio stations stick around and spend the night with me. And the reason is because when you've got three radio stations trying to get that information out, I couldn't do it on my own. I, had to work on the radio stations. So we had a plan. We had people. We had food enough for 2 days' worth. And then I brought in an air mattress, and I slept in the general manager's office. And the situation was, we had sustained winds of 30 or 40 miles an hour with gusts up to 60. And when you're laying there not too far away from the towers, and you hear the wind whipping through them, it's kind of a scary noise, especially when you've got five towers making all that racket. So wasn't a lot of sleep going on.
What images, what's keeping you from going to sleep? What's going through your head when you're hearing that noise?
You wonder if your towers are going to hold up. Now, they are. I mean, they're rated for, 125, 150 miles an hour or something like that. So, your mind is telling you they're, these towers, and they did. They, didn't even sway. They were, we have them inspected every 3 years. The guy wires are tensioned every 3 years. They're thoroughly inspected. They're not going to fall. And your mind tells you that. As I'm laying there, I'm going, they're not going to fall. This is not going to be a problem. But in your mind, that noise is just really intimidating. And you sit there and go, well, you know, so every time, you know, the baseboard heaters would come on, or, you know, you'd hear something creaking or crackling, you bolt upright going, is that a guy wire breaking loose? What is that? And, you know, you look out the window, and through the vertical or the horizontal snow, I could see the towers were, you know, right like that. And I go, okay. And I try to go back to sleep. Now, Burke was showing a little picture of this.
Burke, show that again. We're going to zoom in just a little bit, just a hair to the right of what you... Yo, there you go. You can see some shadows from the towers.
Yeah, now if you look at the bottom of the picture there, that's the studio facility. And then kind of off to the right-hand side is the transmitter building. And then we've got five towers. It's an interesting pattern. We use two towers in the day in a two-tower inline configuration, and then four towers in a parallel configuration at night. Yeah. But they're, you know, they're all 500-foot towers. So, you know, that's a lot of steel sitting there. And they get noisy when wind starts whipping through them. So, you know, it really was a matter of planning in advance. You know, we knew the storm was coming. We knew it was going to be bad. And we had to be there. So we planned ahead, and we had, you know, the food available, and we did all the work in preparation in advance. And we came through the storm just fine. You know, we were all pretty tired, and I needed to go home and sleep for a day. But we made it through okay. And you can see that's the field out in the transmitter field there. Which, by the way, I couldn't get out to those towers right now if I wanted to. There's a lot of snow out there right now.
Oh, is that right? Okay. So even if you had to, wanted to, you could not get out there.
Not to the towers. And that's still the case. The snow is probably up to close to my waist right now. I mean, I could get out there. I would grab some snowshoes or something. But, you know, we could at least get to the transmitter building. But I think the key is, again, you know, is the preparation. On Monday, tested the generators, had them come out and inspect them. You know, we went out and bought the food. We had the plan. We worked the plan when it all happened. And there were no surprises. You know, Wednesday morning or by Wednesday afternoon, the plows came through and we got shoveled out. And we were, you know, without a hitch. So, you know, but all of that came to planning. And I think in this part of the country, you get used to that. You know, this certainly was a unique storm, but it's not anything we haven't ever dealt with before.
You know, someday I hope to have on the show, because I enjoy talking about this topic because I don't know much about it. This idea that you may have to camp out at the transmitter site for a while. Certainly I've heard of, you know, TV transmitter sites and mountaintop transmitter sites, especially where, you know, they kept cots and water and food to eat and, you know, a hot plate and had at least some kind of portable toilet there. All the comforts of home to keep an engineer, you know, somewhat comfortable for a couple of days if you got snowed up there. But one guy, he may be listening to the podcast, Bill Krogan from Las Vegas, takes care of a site. I think it's Mount Potosi that he takes care of there. But there are, and certainly plenty of more sites. I'm sure there's even more spectacular sites around, especially around the western U.S. So good topic for a future show. We ought to have a western engineer on who takes care of some site that's, you know, up in the Rocky Mountains somewhere. When you're getting ready for this kind of bad weather, what kind of priorities go through your mind? As to, you know, how do you think about what could go off, what could go wrong? Are you aware, like, of the state of your various generators? Do you hope that, hey, this site doesn't have a generator? I hope it doesn't go off, but if it does, I've got a backup transmitter, maybe at a different site. What are your contingencies or what are your priorities when you're thinking about we're going to have some serious weather that could do some damage here pretty soon?
Sure. Well, that's a good question. And we actually, that's exactly what we did on Monday is, you know, I came up with a list of the resources that we have and the stations that we have and their locations and what they have for equipment. And I started checking things off. I went, okay, Madison's one of our smaller markets. We don't have generators at the site. So, you know, we kind of assess the risks. What are the risks? The biggest one in a snowstorm is going to be power outages. Really, that's going to be pretty much it is, you know, towers, you know, sure we could have a tower collapse. More likely situation scenario is power outages. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so with Madison, first thing we went is, well, we don't have any generators. So power goes out, power's out. There's nothing we can do. You know, we could call the electric company. They can't get out. There isn't going to be any kind of, you know, we don't have a provision at the moment. We're working on this. We don't have a provision at the moment for a portable generator or anything else. So we just kind of have to call that one DOA for the time being. Now, we are working on getting interconnects so that at least we can bring in portable ones. But it's kind of the Chris Tobin was talking about. There's a risk factor and a financial factor there. And you figure, okay, you know, what's the worst case scenario and how much could we lose? We haven't gotten to that point yet where buying generators for all the sites there makes financial sense. We really haven't had much of a problem there. So with that aside, now we focus on Milwaukee. Well, you know, Milwaukee's a large market. We obviously have generators and auxiliary sites. So then you start planning, okay, where am I best at? Obviously, I need to be in a place where, if the generator comes on or we switch to generator power, 90% of the time, as most engineers will tell you, something doesn't come up right. You know, when the power goes out and the generator comes on, you know, a lot of the critical stuff's on UPSs, but transmitters and the higher power stuff generally isn't. So it shuts off, generator comes on, it comes on. Well, sometimes it doesn't come on. So then you need human intervention. So I needed to be there. If one of the transmitters didn't come on or the generator transfer switch got stuck, any of those things, though remote, are possibilities. And if it were just a rainstorm, well, I could drive in. You know, worst case, we're off the air for a few minutes while I get there. In this case, I couldn't do that. So if for some reason one of those wild scenarios happened, we're dead. You know, there's nothing going on. So we knew that I needed to be there because I needed to be able to access this stuff. So that's how we started to work the plan. And as I said before, three of our stations are at the studio site. Only two of them broadcast from there. The third site is on the other end of town. They don't have a generator, but they do have an auxiliary site that has a generator. They're part of a building downtown, and they're in an office building. So, you know, that's how I went. Okay, so the best place for me to be is the studio site because that's where all three radio stations broadcast from. I can bring the auxiliary site up by telephone, which has a generator. And, I can pretty much, we've got internet connections and things like that, multiple redundant connections. So I can kind of, you know, keep an eye on the weather and set up sort of this control center there and bond everything. So, you know, that's, you know, you really, what you do is you really have to sit there and plan through every scenario. And I do have somebody you mentioned earlier, you know, things like doomsday scenarios with transmitter sites. I do have the ability to run programming on site at all those sites. I do have the ability to pipe in programming from different places in case for some reason, let's say in this situation, the power went off at the studio, but I could keep the transmitters on. I have the ability to run audio either locally or even from our Madison studios or any one of our company stations, really. I could pipe audio in and run audio. So it all kind of boils down to sitting down and coming up with a plan and thinking about all the possible things that could go wrong. And, you know, as an engineer, you have to be willing to do that. You have to be willing to say, yeah, I'm going to leave my family at home. And that's a whole other situation. You know, I left my family at home alone during this storm. You know, who's taking care of them? And, but, you know, that's where, as an engineer, you have to say, well, listen, you know, this is what I do. And as much as I really don't like to not be at home with my family during this, I have to be at work. You know, I have to be sitting there for the greater good, you know, not only to keep our radio station out of the air, but we have a responsibility to the public to inform them on what's going on. You know, that's the most important thing that we do. We have our licenses, and that's a big responsibility. So as engineers, we have to be willing to make that sacrifice and go, I'm going to have to get everything ready at home so I don't have to worry so much about that, so I can go to work and worry about that. And so, first and foremost, it starts with me. And that's, you know, I have to make the plans. I have to be willing to commit to doing it and following through with it and making the effort to stay there.
Have you ever in bad weather had to do something that you felt was physically really dangerous? Like, man, I could get hurt doing this, but this needs to get done.
I do have a limit and we do. I mean, as a company, you know, a dead engineer is no good to anybody. So, you know, I do have blanket authority to shut it down if I need to shut it down. You know, if it gets to a situation where I really am in danger, I can just shut it down and we still off the air. What we did is, we do have that policy, but I, you know, there really hasn't been any situations where I really thought that I was in immediate danger. There are some times that, there are some times where I was a little concerned, lightning coming down and you're standing next to five big lightning rods, or you're in the studio building and, with an AM, you're getting hit over and over with lightning. There are situations like that. And there have been times when I've said, this transmitter's off the air, but there's lightning around. I'm going to wait until it's done. So,
sure.
You do have to use some common sense. I'll push the envelope occasionally, but again, our policy and our company policy is that we don't put ourselves in danger.
Chris, how about you? Planning for emergencies in New York City, especially when most of your stuff, your FMs, are on the Empire State Building, that's got to be different than planning for it out in the Midwest, where you've got some diverse sites here and there. You're in the middle of a city, so how does your contingency planning work there?
Well, it starts with training with three letters, NBC, not the National Broadcasting Company, but nuclear, biological, and chemical training. Believe it or not, I've had to take this type of training because we're in an urban center, and as you know, we're in a very volatile world these days. So many things we plan for disaster recovery. Or business continuity planning. One, I keep a go kit, if you will, or a backpack in my office for those times when I get the phone call. Hey, you're going to be staying here because of X, as we'll say 9/11, a nor'easter storm comes through and more snow is expected to land than predicted. We've had many incidences where we had a chemical spill once and a neighborhood had to be evacuated. So, things like that. We have off-site studio locations that I can't divulge where they are, but we do have them, so that if we have to vacate our current facility, we can relocate. As Chris pointed out with his facilities, he can move to an off-site location and bring in audio to the transmitter site. We have alternate transmitter sites that can talk to the other transmitter sites, so we can flip-flop and zigzag audio back and forth depending on the need. It's a daunting task, because you can't really plan for just any one scenario. A lot of times we have our disaster planning meetings about every 3 months, and we do the what-if scenario meeting and say, okay, what if this happens? What's our plan? And we run through the binder and go, yeah, we're covered. Good. All right, what if this happens? Go through the binder. We have no idea what to do. All right, let's sit down and start strategizing. So that's how we go about it. You have to, because, think of it this way. Half the staff is on the subway heading home, or the metro, depending on how you want to call it. And then there's a blackout. Now what do you do? Yeah. Those staffers that are back at the radio station have just switched to generator automatically, but half the engineering staff may not be available. So now you have to have manuals or booklets or something to explain what to do in the event of. So we got a lot of stuff, and it's a living thing. It's always morphing, changing, evolving, if you will, aging, basically. It's a daunting task. It's not easy. It's no different, I guess, if you anywhere else you try to do disaster recovery. We just have to take it to two steps higher, because the chances of it happening more often are probably greater with us. Blackouts during the summertime.
And the other thing is, it's just always something you never thought of.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Well, here, we had a blackout several years ago here in New York City, Northeast, as we're all aware of. And people took for granted that they could go to one of our transmitter sites at a building in Midtown to replace the DAT tape for the backup audio that suddenly stopped playing. Don't ask me why or how these people didn't realize what was going on, that they couldn't achieve their goal, but I got into an argument with them. That building, located on 5th Avenue and 34th Street, stands about 1,300 feet tall. You might see it from time to time in the skyline of Manhattan, the Empire State Building. Do you think, during a blackout, that you might not be able to gain access to your transmitter room for some reason or another, even if you have the proper ID? Okay? Couldn't convince certain staff members why we couldn't go to the transmitter site to do changes to tapes and make things happen. Whatever we did had to be done remotely over our STLs, which were wireless, thank goodness, and on our generator power and of that sort. So when you're doing disaster planning, you have to think of the ultimate. What if you can't get to the site because of X? And that was a perfect example. Nobody understood why. It's just a building. Yeah, it's not just an ordinary building. So if you have transmitter sites located in a landmark facility or a place in town that's considered a very sensitive area, you might not be able to get to it during a storm, blackouts, who knows what. So you have to think of everything. You're never, you never know of everything.
Here's something interesting that we do in Wisconsin that we just started with the Department of Justice and the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association. I actually carry an ID card that's labeled essential broadcast personnel that has my picture on it. And that will get me through a lot of things to get to a transmitter site in an emergency. It should allow me to pass through police lines and those sorts of things to get to transmitter sites. So yes, that's something that the state has established. And I think, yeah, they're doing that in New York as well, aren't they?
Yes. Yes, we do have that in New York City. I do have an ID, several actually. It's just not one. Several IDs that would permit me to get to that building. However, that building is private property, so they do have the option to deny me access. Odds are that wouldn't happen. During the blackout, I could gain access because I did have the proper identification. And yes, we do have that in New York City. Most of the broadcasters in town, the engineers and essential personnel, if you will, do have those cards. It's handy. We also, at our facility, we have press passes from the New York City Police Department. So in conjunction with the press pass and the special ID, you can pretty much get anywhere. It's kind of crazy, though, when you do cross those lines.
Well, and what you're talking about, too, is we do the same thing in Milwaukee as well. Like, you know, that site that I'm talking about on the that's not at the studio. We have a wired remote control. We have wireless remote control. We have T1. We have microwave. I have a PC there that's constantly running programming in a loop that I can switch to. I've got ISDN. I've got dial-up. So, I mean, you know, it would take a lot to bring it down completely. And, you know, that just, again, comes from that planning where we sit down and we run through different scenarios and go, well, where would we get stuck? Okay, how do we get over that? You know, where's our point of failure here? And, you know, it takes some time to do that and it takes some time to set it up, but, you know, you get a little more confident during these emergency situations that things are going to be okay.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what you do. You practice and you go through those scenarios so that when and if something does present itself in a bad way, you're prepared. And even if it's something you didn't plan for, you can at least approach it and go, all right, I have no idea how to handle this because we never really planned for it, but I have enough in place that I can move things around and recover. And that's what the goal is. That's what I've been doing for years with a lot of our folks and going through training and showing people what to do. I spent some time with the AT&T folks years ago down in New Jersey with their network operations center and talking with them about how they manage their entire data network, the AT&T global network from one building. Actually, there's two buildings. The second one, nobody knows where it's located, unless, of course, you work for AT&T. And they literally, randomly, once a month, will call the staff and say, you're going to Site B tomorrow. That's all they'll tell them on the phone. And they go to Site B, and then Site A literally shifts all responsibility of the entire AT&T global network over to this Site B, and they run for the day to debug, make sure everything they're doing works so that in the event of catastrophic failure at Site A, they can operate the network, provide their customers with what they need without interruption. I got to watch part of that because, you know, a lot of it is classified business, you know, non-disclosure stuff. But to watch that function and to be able to confidently sit at a computer console and the guy goes, okay, I've got no more control of Europe. That's it. I'm out. And somebody else has it. And it's seamless. I mean, it's just wild. So if you can take that and bring it down to our level, you know, apply it to our particular model, business model, yes, you should definitely be confident. And like a lifeguard or a firefighter, when the emergency occurs, you approach it, you know how to handle it, and you go for it. And it's wild.
Hey, we'll continue our discussion in just a moment. But first, I want to give you a word about our sponsor, the exclusive sponsor of This Week in Radio Tech for this episode, and that is Axia Audio. Now, Axia was the inventor of the connected IP audio studio with audio nodes, mixing engines, Ethernet switches, audio consoles. And one of the things that really benefits when you put an IP studio into your facility is the connectedness with all the other brands of equipment out there, all the things that you need to build a studio. For example, if we're just talking about delivery system partners, automation systems, no matter what automation you have, they're probably a partner with Axia. So Axia plugs right in with one cable for audio, for GPIO, for metadata. For example, companies like Broadcast Electronics, do you have an Audio Vault? They're a partner. BSI, Broadcast Software International with their OpEx software. Burley Software, Dabis, Dalet, David, Digimedia, Digispot, Enco, Fraunhofer, OMT Technologies, Netia, Paravel Systems, Pristine Systems, RCS, Cineden, Wide Orbit, Wind Media, and Xenon Media. Those are the partners. All these companies are partnered with Axia Audio. That means they plug right in to Axia's LiveWire IP audio network. Plus, there are hardware development partners as well. So in other words, these other brands of hardware plug right in to an Axia IP audio network, like equipment from 25/7, from Audio Science. Yes, Audio Science makes a sound card that plugs right into an Axia LiveWire network. Digigram, International Data Casting, Linear Acoustic, Nautel, of course, Omnia does, a sister company, Radio Systems, another console manufacturer, Sound 4, and of course, Telos as well. So if you want to take advantage of the benefits of an IP audio network, well, what better way than to connect it to the partner equipment or the partner automation systems or even partner system integrators who know how to put these things together for you very quickly. You can check all these things out, all these partner companies that plug right into an Axia LiveWire network on the website at axiaaudio.com/partners. That's axiaaudio.com/partners. You're going to find the benefits of IP audio, not just the fact that it's connected with Ethernet IP and it's standardized. It adheres to all the standards of Ethernet IP, things like RTP, real-time protocol, IGMP, that's Internet Group Management Protocol, UDP for data packets, and QoS for quality of service. You're going to find all these standards are adhered to by LiveWire IP audio, and that's why all these other companies can build equipment and build systems that plugs right into it. Hey, it's a joy to put together. I've done it a number of times myself, and I'd like you to experience that benefit as well. Check out Axia Audio on the web at axiaaudio.com.
You know, you're talking about backup sites, Chris Tobin, and I was just thinking, well, we just heard from our sponsor, Axia, and I know the folks at Sirius Satellite Radio have a whole backup facility, studio after studio after studio, dozens of studios that are all equipped with our sponsors' audio consoles, Axia audio consoles, at the backup site. I don't think I'm allowed to say where it is, and actually, I haven't seen it myself. So.
Yeah, I know where it is. Yeah, I've seen it. I know the site. Okay. Yeah.
All right. Well, cool. When you're thinking about backup, okay, New York City, this seems like a reasonably easy decision because, every minute, as you said, is worth thousands of dollars. So you've got to be on the air. What about, smaller towns and burgs? Okay, Milwaukee's a good-sized city. But, I have some stations in Mississippi, small town, Cleveland, Mississippi, small town, Clarksdale, Mississippi. And then we have some in Greenville, Mississippi as well, and a couple stations out in American Samoa. What do we do for backup? Because, our dollars per minute are nothing like New York's, but the equipment costs, close to the same.
I'll tell you what, Kirk, I can answer that because I just did that. Madison, I was just mentioning before, where, that price to, income to outgoing ratio is kind of messed up for the math on that. But what I ended up doing in that situation, I do have one site that has a generator, but of course, with no power at the studio, that doesn't do a lot of good. So what I did is I scrounged up enough used equipment, either through other stations in our company or through stuff that we've replaced over the years, and had enough to cobble together a functioning studio. Now, it's not the kind of equipment that I'd want to have at a main studio all the time, but it certainly could easily be pressed into service at any moment. It's a functioning console. We've got an old microphone, a couple of the CD players. I even saved one of our old automation systems and put that in there for audio playback. So it would work, and it didn't really cost us much at all other than some elbow grease to put it all together. So I think in some of those situations, that's certainly possible.
Oh, absolutely. So
facility, we have a transmitter site that is actually in just outside of Mound Bayou, Mississippi, and it's where our 3-kilowatt FM site is. But the electricity there is not so reliable, and our backup site is actually at our studio. We have a little single bay ring stub antenna, fairly inexpensive educational style FM antenna, and we can feed upwards of 250 watts into it. We have a translator transmitter that is in our studio building that does run 24/7. But if we ever needed to put our main frequency on the air, we could do it from our studio building where we might have more reliable power. We actually don't have a generator there, but we could. So that's one way of getting backup. We also have, for example, if our we have an Axia audio console there, if our IP audio network were to fail for some reason, then we can put the automation system directly on the air and then continue to feed other programming, the automation update spots and such as that. So there are things that you can do, even on a really inexpensive scale. And believe me, we operate very inexpensively in little Cleveland, Mississippi, to give yourself some back. Yeah, Chris?
If I could jump in real quick, you know what? Some markets are doing, some smaller markets, you're seeing this more and more as solid-state transmitters come out, is they're acting as backups for each other. For example, you put up a broadband antenna, and they have the backup to be frequency agile, and the main station, the host station, and the other backup station can share the transmitter.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Mr. Tobin, you were about to say something before I went into my thing about
space. Oh, no. I agree with you. You can do stuff very simple and still achieve a backup plan. And again, it depends on the market, where you are. If your station is important to the community, you can find ways to preserve that connection from you to the community and make things happen. And today's technology is so simple to do it with. You don't have to get crazy. I mean, 20 years ago, yeah, there was pretty much a standard template you'd have to follow if you wanted to ensure your broadcast would be consistent. Today, you can do it very easily with a computer or, a small mixer, a console, or anything, and off you go. And you can still preserve that link with the community.
So the remaining minutes we have here on the show, what I want to discuss is, how do you prioritize? We talked about prioritizing when you're getting ready for an emergency. How do you prioritize, or how do you do triage, so to speak, if you've got a number of things wrong? Imagine, Chris Tarr, that the wind blew really hard and one of your towers had a lot of rust on one of the turnbuckles on the guy wire, and a tower came down. And when that tower came down, it hit the guy wire for another tower and caused that tower to, kind of lean over a little bit. It looked like it might collapse. Let's say it's not endangering the building. But then you have a power outage in the building. Okay, let's say the tower that fell also fell on the power lines, right? So now you're on generator with not all your towers. Hey, maybe you've got somebody in the building who's hurt. Maybe there was a big spark or something when the power lines got felled. How do you prioritize what you're going to do in relation to, the business needs, the needs of your community that you're licensed to? Imagine there's, the mayor or the emergency agency official wants to get on the air and tell people about, hey, at the same time, the weather is so bad luck, a freight train derailed, and there's a hydrogen sulfide that is spewing out over a neighborhood. How do you prioritize this thing? What's important in that kind of multiple disaster scenarios? Not that I wish that upon you.
Well, I think the first thing would obviously be our internal employees. The person that's injured, we would tend to them first and get that situation stabilized. That is the most important thing, is the people involved, making sure they're okay. After that, it would obviously be, we can't broadcast without power. So we have to make sure the generator is working and that we have power coming in. Then, okay, which station can we get on the air again? Obviously, with towers falling, getting the AM back up is probably not going to happen as quickly as, for example, going to one of our auxiliary FM sites and at least getting something on the air, even if it's just simulcasting from one studio, even a makeshift studio. So you kind of have to, you have that hierarchy of needs. And, obviously, the first one is making sure everybody's okay. Then secondarily, okay, we can't broadcast without powers. Let's find a power source or a place that has power and set up there. Then the third is, okay, getting the signal from point A to point B. Well, if, the towers are down and we have no way to broadcast from that facility, we do have other facilities. So let's get the ISDN line in, or let's get the IP connection going and get something on. And we may be at low power, but at least we're on and are getting the information out. Once we do all that, the immediate need is getting something on the air. Once that's done, then we can slow down a little bit, assess the situation, and figure out what our next move is. And in my situation, be calling for some assistance. We probably start immediately determining, what parts we need to order, what we need to get from our vendors, and that sort of thing. And I would imagine, within the first day, we'd have stuff on a truck on the way up here. So that's kind of how I would look at that situation.
Let's think of that. It's a couple of days later now, and your AM is off the air, because imagine you have just one tower and the tower's down, but your transmitter building is okay. I'm thinking of a situation we had in Clarksdale, Mississippi, when high winds took a tower down. Talk about techniques for getting an AM station back on the air when you have no tower.
You know, it's interesting. We have on broadcastengineering.info, our engineering site, we actually have a guy from, I want to say it's Australia or New Zealand, who posed that question because he just had a storm come through and take out his tower and was asking for some suggestions. And we all got together and we're trying to come up with some ideas for him. And with AM, there's long wire, there's, diplexing on another tower that we can find. But generally, you know, you can load just about anything with AM. So if you can find a long enough piece of wire and some coils and capacitors to kind of, you know, to match it as well as you can, that'll get you on the air. I mean, even if you can't even find anything to tune it with, if you can get a wire out there that's long enough, you can get some power into it and radiate. So with AM, that's generally the case. You know, you try to do as much as you can to get something connected to your transmitter that will radiate. And it's usually some random piece of wire. With FM, you can get a little more creative. You can get a crane. You can do all sorts of things to lift a bay up into the air and get something going.
Chris, in a place like New York City, would you ever have to do something like string a long wire to get a station back on the air? You guys have enough built-in, industrial strength backup there.
Well, we have enough backup. If we had to, we have two AM sites geographically separated from each other by several miles. So if, say, one site suffered physical damage, we could find a way to diplex probably a third signal onto the tower. The good thing is that our sites are far enough away from most situations that could cause an issue. Even with the storms that come through, they're reinforced because they're along the shoreline. So I'm not saying that it's not impossible, but yeah, we're prepared. And if we have to, we have FM sites that have alternate locations that I could get creative and string a long wire across the rooftop and make something happen. So yeah, we could do it. We have the wherewithal to.
Gotcha. Well, guys, we're going to have to wrap up our show here pretty soon. And I want to take on this a pick of the week information. Whatever you think is cool, that is your pick of the week. Let's talk about that. And I've got one, but I'm just getting the URL for it dialed in here right now. So who's ready? Mr. Tarr, are you ready? You got something cool to talk about this week?
It's kind of cool, I guess. Yeah, I really couldn't think of anything completely engineering related. But there is something that I use all the time that some people haven't figured out yet or don't know about. And that is, and it's great for small radio stations. If you're in charge of IT for a small radio station, Google now allows you to use your own domain with Google services. So, for example, my Geek Jedi email, it goes through what they call Google Apps, and you can have your own email address, but using the Google interface, which I think is great. It's been around for a while. A lot of people know about it, but it is something that I actually recommend to a lot of smaller companies. I do some IT work for a company my wife works for, has about 10 people. And, you know, struggling to try to keep email servers working and everything else, we just moved it all to Google, and it works great. So if you host your own website or you host your own email, yeah, check out Google Apps. It's free, which is the best part.
Huh. And so what's the first thing you would do to implement this?
Well, they have actually several steps to do it. And you know, what I usually have done is kind of run them both in parallel. And with Google Apps, they allow you to kind of route email to two different accounts in the beginning just to get things migrated. And then once you're done, it's just setting it up is as simple as changing the mail exchange records for your domain to start delivering to the Google account. But what's great is you can do internal web chat. You can share documents. It's great. And again, you know, there's a little bit of advertising. They also have a paid version, which is $50 per person per year, which I have. And with that, you get some really great spam filtering through this thing called Postini, which Google bought a couple of years ago, and some other things that they turbocharge. But it's a great deal for smaller businesses. And if you're like a consulting engineer, you know, get rid of the AOL.com domain. You know, set yourself up a little website. The Google Apps thing has the ability to do that as well and make yourself look really professional. So if you're one man, like I am, kind of a one man guy doing some engineering work, it's a great way to make your stuff look really professional.
Cool. That is very cool. And so you go to Google Apps, and this is called what? What would you look for?
Oh, it's called Google Apps for your domain. I think they've shortened it now to just Google Apps for Business. And it's like I said, there's a free version, and then you can upgrade to the paid version.
Gotcha. All right, Mr. Tobin, do you have a pick of the week for us this week?
Yes, it's actually a very simple thing. It's called stickynotes.net. It's sticky-notes.net. It's just a mimics what you use to post-its, the little yellow piece of paper or pink or blue, whatever you might have. What's nice about it is you can transfer these guys across your LAN, or you can email the attachments, and it's just that they are sticky notes, and you can remind yourself to do things. I've been using it recently for the last couple of months in meetings. Have my laptop with me in a meeting. I'm sitting there taking notes, just typing away, and then when we're done, I just drop it across the LAN to my desktop at the office, because our company LAN is all over the place in the city, so I can be anywhere. And that way I have a second copy, okay, a backup, just in case something goes wrong with my notebook, my laptop, and I lose everything. It's been great. It's handy. It's not an engineering thing special or any technology, electronics, but it's an electronic version of a sticky note. And I've enjoyed it. And I think others will find it that way too.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to recommend three little things, two of which most people already know about, but they're just wonderful little apps for your Windows machines. CCleaner, also known as Crap Cleaner. CCleaner does a marvelous job. I probably run this thing two times a week, and it just seems to keep my Windows machine. I have a Windows installation on a MacBook Pro, just running it at top performance, and I keep the registry all pretty and everything. Some people say it doesn't matter, and I think it does. The CCleaner from Piriform, PIRIFORM, and then there's also Defraggler, and I really like this defragger called Defraggler. Defraggler. If you just Google Defraggler, you'll find it. And it seems to be a really efficient, nice little defragging program. It doesn't run in the background. You have to run it yourself, as far as I know. But it also does some interesting things, like it'll defrag your free space. And you can, if you've got a couple of files that it just doesn't want to defrag, you can go hit those files individually and defrag them if you want to. Now, the main thing I don't know how I ran across this. And hey, half of you probably know about it, and if you don't, you will now. If you use Outlook, you know that your outlook.pst file can get corrupted and can really slow down the performance of Outlook. And I have put up sometimes with Outlook being a poor performer for several weeks in a row until I decided, oh yeah, that's right. There's this program called ScanPST, and you can download that. It may already be on your computer with some installations of Outlook. But just look around your computer or download scanpst.exe, and this unfortunately you do have to specify the location of your .pst file. You'd think that would be somewhat standardized, or it could go find it itself. But you got to go dig many folders deep to find your .pst file. Once you do, specify where it is, and it will scan that file. And man, I have had all kinds of problems with Outlook just fixed up by using scanpst, and That is a good thing. It seems to work. Oh, what's this? Ah, everyone trying to to load it. Okay. All right. Hey, guys, we're going to call our program to an end. We've been talking about emergency procedures and preparedness and what you actually do when disaster strikes. Thanks a lot to the chat room for making some comments there. And thanks very much to Chris Tarr and Chris Tobin for being with us. Tom Ray wasn't able to be with us tonight. Chris, thanks very much from New York City. And Chris Tarr from Wanago.
Oh, you're welcome.
Appreciate y'all very, very much. And I've been in a different location myself in Dallas, Texas. Thanks very much to Cumulus Media and Brett Blankenship in particular for allowing me to use this production room studio here at Cumulus on Maple Avenue in downtown Dallas, Texas. I'm in one of the production rooms here, and you can see the sound diffusing board behind me. It's a very nice production room, but I think they're getting ready to pack it up and move it out and move it all to a new place with some new equipment. Thanks for joining us. Our program today has been sponsored exclusively by the folks at Axia. Check them out on the web at axiaaudio.com. I'm Kirk Harnack. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.
When you're building one studio or 10 studio, how about building studios that are connected not only to each other, but to the devices you actually use, like codecs, hybrids, automation systems, and audio processors? Check out all the partners of Axia Audio on the web at axiaaudio.com/partners.
That's all the bandwidth we can pill for this week. Another tort has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
This week in Radio Tech.
Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show.
Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes Store.
Soliciting is strictly encouraged. If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here.
Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny LePay Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.